Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, welcome back. Today we're going to talk more about representing older youth. And the way we want to go about this is by taking the principles that we really advocate for in representing kids in general and applying them a little more specifically to representing older youth. We do want to refer you back to one of our earlier podcasts. It was called The Art of Building Trust with Your Client. That is incredibly important with older youth. And that gives you kind of the basis for what we want to talk about today, which is really developing the strategy. This is something that you want to do in every single case, but with older youth, a lot of times you feel like you're getting dragged around and there is no strategy and we're just dealing with running away and other issues that come up and we don't, you know, it just pulls everybody off course. And as the child's attorney, it's really important that you make that happen. So we encourage you to go back and listen to that other podcast, but a couple of things to keep in mind with older youth. Many of them have probably experienced more trauma than your younger clients and have been let down again and again by adults. So they most likely have a pretty sensitive BS meter and they can detect any kind of inauthenticity. And so as you think about how you relate to your older youth, and this kind of goes back to an earlier podcast too, but it's be yourself. You're not there to be their friend. Don't try to be their friend. Don't try to be someone that they want to hang out with. You're there to be their lawyer and their advisor. And so I think we just want to remind you that building that trust is critically important, but today we're going to talk about really how you develop a strategy with them so that they have bought into it.
And what you said there, Angela, is really important about not trying to be their friend, because what we want is their, we want to have a attorney-client relationship with them. We need them to trust us, right? Because we're going to at some point need to give them counsel and advice, and that we need them to take it. We want them to take it. We want them to respect us and trust us. That's not the same thing as being popular with them or being their friend. Now, one thing that's really important with the older kids is to get to know them by their records. I can't tell you how many times I thought I knew what the situation was because a kid was really open with me, telling me their family history and what was going on and why they were having trouble getting along with their mom or whatever. And then I get their past records and I read their child abuse history, right? The abuse reports on the family going back to when my client was born, right? And now I start to see things that I had no idea my client had endured as a young child. You know, I just had a case where I thought I knew everything. And then I find out that when she was 5 years old, she was banging her head against the car window every time her mom took her anywhere, and that she had been exposed to sexual abuse at a very young age. Had no clue until I got that abuse history. And suddenly I thought I was looking through, you know, I thought the picture was clear, like at the eye doctor when they slide the lens back and forth on your eye test. And then you think, well, that's pretty good. And then he goes, how about this? And they slide the lens. Everything came into focus once I read the prior abuse reports on this child.
I got to stop you there for 1 second, because one of the great things that's happening now is there are a lot of lived experience experts that are talking more to attorneys. And what you hear a lot of times is, I am not my file. And some of that stuff in there isn't even true. So how do you balance? I agree with what you're saying, but how do you balance that out with being, I don't know, skeptical of what you're reading? Or, you know, how do you do that in a way that it doesn't color the way you relate to that individual?
Well, I think this is only step one, really. Getting to know the paper, and then you go out and you get to know the person. But step one is so important, because like John is saying there, there's landmines hidden in the past, some not detonated yet. And so I think it's really important to do step one and do your due diligence, do your homework. Then you go out and you meet the person and it becomes real. You meet their resilience, you meet their sensitivity, you meet all these things about them. And it's almost like if you imagine somebody wrote your psychosocial bio down and said, oh, I know Angela, or I know John, because I read about him. No. And then you can go out and meet the person. But if they wrote a lot of things in your past that you don't talk about, that you don't share openly on a first meeting or a second or third meeting with people, but if they wrote that down, then they would know things about you going in that maybe they would need to know to really help you or get to know you. So it's a two-step process, at least, at least these two steps.
It's also not always cohesive, right? Like I've done it both ways. And honestly, there's a part of me that prefers not reading anything, because when I was a younger practitioner, I didn't like the fact that I would read about my client and then I would go into a meeting and I would have all these preconceptions. And I would always walk away with, what was I worried about? He's just a kid. She's just a kid. I love the spending time with them. They were great. But the paper put me on edge, just reading the paper file. Like, wow, everything this kid has been through and been diagnosed with and all these medications that don't work. That, you know, you go into a meeting with someone after reading all that about them, you're naturally going to be a little bit guarded. And I didn't like that effect it would have on me as a younger attorney. And sometimes, honestly, you got to go out and meet your client first thing, and you don't have any background either. So like the example I just gave, it was basically just a long time trying to get those records. And in the meantime, I'm talking to the child, I'm talking to the mother, I'm talking to the case manager, and then I get the records. And that's when everything came into focus. So yeah, you're going to do it either way.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And it may just be a function of your practice. You know, how many times are you going to get to see your client in person? Is it important that you have all that in front of you, or are you waiting? You don't not go see your client because you don't have all the records. So, I mean, some of it's practical, but I just wanted to kind of raise that because I know sometimes, I know I've read files on kids that contain things that maybe aren't exactly right, or someone's perception of the child. So it's a balance like everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when you go to meet the older client, right? I think you've got to put things, you've got to adjust your thinking. You've got to remember something about teenagers. Like I just said, right? I go out and meet them. I go, they're just a kid. They're a kid like every other kid, right? And so teenagers are wired to do what we all did as teenagers, which is to push off, right? Is to push off the dock. That's your job as a teenager. I'm seeking independence. I'm pushing away. And who do we push away from? We push away from our parents, right? They're the dock and we're pushing away from them. Our clients, most of them, don't have anything to push off from, right? So if you think about that for a second, what does that do to the teenage psyche to not have that constant dock to push off of in a healthy way? Well, they're pushing, it seems to me, in my layperson's opinion, that's why they push away from everything and everyone. They're pushing, constantly pushing away. So you put them in a great foster home and you're like, oh, they're going to be so grateful. For some reason, this great family has taken a flyer on my client. I can't wait to see how happy my client is when I go to see them. And it's the complete opposite. And the foster mom's like, that's horrible. Get her out of here. Why aren't you grateful? No, she's just being a teenager, right? So if you adjust your thinking and you realize that's who you're going to meet, then a lot of the behaviors, quote unquote, behaviors aren't really, you know, behaviors, right? They're just being a teenaged human being.
You know, pushing off is part of it, but also just testing. You know, you think about, like, again, as a parent of a 13 and 15-year-old at the moment, they're constantly pushing and pushing to see, like, what happens if I do this and what happens, you know, but they always know I'm going to be here. And these kids get disappointed again and again. They test the foster home and the call comes and they get a trash bag and off they go, you know? So I think we have to recognize that same kind of thing, which is the testing behavior is normal too, but they don't get the same response of a dedicated family member that a lot of folks do. And so you might get some of that directed at you as the child's attorney, and just recognizing how important it is to weather that and just keep showing up, like you guys always say.
Well, yeah, in some small sense, you're right that the attorney starts to provide what developmental experts call a sense of security. And it's one of the developmental stages for young children. I was just talking to a psychologist about this. You know, they got the food and the shelter and then a sense of security. And that's what the consistent caregiver for an infant is doing by being the same person showing up all the time. That's the sense of security that there's an adult looking out for me here. To an extent, sadly, a small extent, I think the attorney for the older child becomes a small sense of security, as that I'm 16, I'm 17, I'm heading towards 18. And I have this person who has a plan. I have this person who is there to advise me. And it, I think it does become, unfortunately for the kids, we do play that role of some small sense of security that's kind of important when you're heading into the unknown. So it can be beneficial to be a consistent presence. And it's one reason these kids are going to take a little bit more of your time on your caseload, I think.
Right. That's where we're getting at with these, with this, right? Is that these kids are, right? They're like wild, untamed energy, right? And that's the thing about, that's what we said early on, well, how it's like one of these kids can take up an inordinate amount of time percentage-wise on your caseload, right? And it's because they're leading, like we said in the last episode, they're leading the litigation, they're leading the charge. They're in charge of the strategy by whatever kind of thing they want to do the night before that makes your phone light up the next day. And what we're talking about, the first step is, okay, can I get this kid to trust me and respect me? Then maybe I will be able to counsel and advise them on a strategy for getting them out of foster care, albeit at the age of 18, but it's still getting out of foster care. So your core principle here, the mission of your representation, is still the same as it is with a one-year-old. I'm going to get you safely out of foster care. That's the goal.
And, you know, we've talked about being authentic and being, you knowing your role, not trying to be cool and popular and well-liked by your clients, but establishing this, this credibility with them. How do you take that? And then, you know, when the meeting comes and the social worker asks, you know, what are your goals in life? How do you help them through that in the role as your attorney, balancing, you know, their hopes and dreams with the reality that they're sitting in at the moment? How do you help them set goals?
Well, I think what I like to do when you talk about like being authentic yourself, because they can tell when you're not, I think you try to be authentic and real with the situation that they're in. I like to frame the situation for them in a realistic light, not too negative, not too positive, hopefully. But then I like to frame their future for them also in a realistic and hopefully positive way. And you can have kids who have totally, you know, total delusions of grandeur about their future. And then you can have kids who see the future as a post-apocalyptic wasteland. And the truth is, the truth's usually somewhere in the middle. So you can try and create like a realistic roadmap for them of the future that encompasses their bigger dreams, but shorter term goals, that steps that get them there, that ground them in reality. I mean, I've had clients with those two visions of their future wrapped in one child who sees the future simultaneously as this great magical place and also this terrible, lonely place of despair, depending on the day, right? So I feel like it's our job to ground them in a reality that's achievable in terms of short-term goals. But as far as big goal setting, I'd never try to dissuade that or squash that. I try and let it breathe and let it be open to possibility, because if that's what's driving them forward, then they need that drive to get them through GED classes, right?
Right. Well, we were talking the other day about a child that, you only had a couple of credits, but wanted to be a veterinarian. Maybe give an example of how you would help them with steps toward a long-term goal. I mean, a lot of this is what you would do, you know, with any child in your life, but maybe that's a good example talk through.
Yeah, you sit in an independent living staffing or a school meeting, and someone asks the child, what do you want to be? And the child will say something like, well, like I want to be a veterinarian or a lawyer. And yet, you know, simultaneously in that same meeting, they'll say, well, you know, how many high school credits does she have or he have? You know, 2.5. Okay, so you get 2.5 credits and supposed to graduate this year. Okay, well, that's so So, you know, vet school or law school is really looking distant right now. But you don't say that to the client, right? Like Jim said, you don't quash their goals and dreams. You do both, right? So I think you want to strategize in a way that keeps their dream alive, but also you're creating a softer landing spot. Like, hey, if you shoot for the stars, you might land on the moon. Let me prepare a landing for you on the moon, because the stars, we might not make it there. So, you know, you can get them, you can use it to, you know, maybe make them go to school. How about we show up? You know, hey, you want to be a vet? How about we show up? And if they start to sour on the vet thing, but maybe they love animals, then you can show them other options that they are completely unaware of. And that's what we as adults constantly forget about all kids, including our own kids. We really don't prepare them for adulthood. Everyone just enters and starts banging around into stuff and learning most of what we know by banging into stuff, right? And so the kid doesn't realize, oh, I can be a veterinary technician. I don't have to be a vet. I don't have to go to college with my 2.5 high school credits. I can work in a vet's office, or I can work, I can, if you live in a horse community or near a horse community like I do, then you can make a really nice living working, caring for horses in stables, the riding stables. You know, there's all kinds of other things that kids don't know about that we do as adults. And it's all part of getting them safely and securely out of foster care. You know, some people probably listen to us and say, these are children's attorneys I'm listening to. What does this have to do with the practice of law that they're talking about? And I get it. But no, it's about more than just getting my client out of foster care at 18 with a big black hefty bag full of their belongings, which, you know, Jim and I have practiced long enough to remember those days when that is what happened to foster kids. You know, see you, bye. And they literally had all their belongings in a garbage bag. End of foster care. No independent living, nothing, on the streets. Letting them, not doing these steps that we're talking about, is akin to that. I feel like, you know, sending an 18-year-old out into the world and not and letting them think they're going to become a veterinarian when they you know, they're 18 and they're still a sophomore in high school, that's not fair. That's just like sending them out with a garbage bag full of their belongings and no support.
Well, and just kind of generally speaking, when we talk about the veterinarian, my brother thought he wanted to be a vet, and he did one internship in the summer and he hated it. Like, it's so there is some real value in trying to help them get an experience like that. And they may love it. They may love horses. They may be, you know, and then maybe they find a path to become a veterinarian one day. But that very real experience of getting into a field they're interested in to another level is a great idea. I mean, how many paralegals do you know that end up becoming lawyers and figuring out a way to go to law school? So I think it's both, right? It's being realistic, but it's also helping them along that path to figuring out something in their life that they can be excited about and, you know, and learn whether it really is their calling or not.
Right. And for us as children's lawyers, right, it all comes back to strategy. What's the strategy? It's to get you out of foster care safely and successfully, right? We're not trying to, you know, be life coaches here or mentors or surrogate parents. We're trying to be children's lawyers whose clients are at a significant disadvantage because of the mere fact they were raised in foster care. So we need to try to make up for as many of those deficits for them as we can. So when they enter adulthood, they are not handicapped by the mere fact that they were raised in foster care and they didn't have any adult in their life who would explain to them that there can be a plan B that you might actually be happier with than your initial plan A of, I want to be a vet or I want to be a football player and anything else won't make me happy. We've got to help them plan for adulthood. And some, like Jim said too, we have to also just talking with them gives them the idea that there is a future, right? Because for many of our clients, the future, their context for life beyond a certain age or any kind of success, they don't have any context for it, right?
Along that point, it's important to share some vision of the future with them so that they can see it. And that's part of where we're trying to move the practice of representing older kids, because it's where we used to be at and still are sometimes, is that you don't want to just be going out and asking what's wrong. What you want to be is going out and seeing your clients and asking what's next. That's what you want to be asking the older client, is what are we doing next? What's our next goal? What's our next step?
Well, and to follow up, Jim, on that, you know, we're talking really about helping them develop a vision for their future that they can kind of go back to and they can look to as they're deciding the choices they're going to make. But we know even once we establish that, all teenagers are going to make choices, you know, that don't advance, you know, they don't move them in the direction of the goal. How, like, what are some of the strategies you do when you're representing an older youth who maybe you've got a plan with them and you're working on it, but they continually, they run away, they stop going to school? Like, what are some of the strategies you use to keep them on track with the plan that you've developed together?
Well, I think the first thing you do is you don't overreact or freak out like the system does. We always say these kids get measured by their worst 5-10 minutes,
right?
In any 30-day, 60-day period. All anyone wants to talk about is that terrible 10 minutes where they freaked out and broke a window or ran away. So you don't overreact to the failures, and you try and take the power away from the failure behavior and put the power and the attention towards the positive behavior and the positive trajectory. Because this is going to be peaks and valleys, right? This chart is not going to, this trajectory is not going to go straight up. It's right. Going to go up and down. And we know that. So the arrests, the runaways, they're part of a process. They're not necessarily the enemy, so to speak. They're not something you're going to eradicate. And you can't say, well, I failed because they got arrested again. No. And I've taken that tack in court, in delinquency court. I'll go in on my clients and everyone's reacting a certain way. And I'm like, okay, so what, basically? Okay, can we move on from this? Because I want to talk about how the GPA has gone up 2 points in the last 6 months, because that's all I care about. School attendance is up. And so you can refocus the court. You can refocus the other attorneys. And sometimes you can refocus your client that way too. But they're going to fail, right? Anyone who knows teenagers knows they're going to fail. These kids especially, they're going to have their share of failures. And I try to, like I said, I try to ask what's next a lot, even immediately after a failure. I try to point out that this was off our roadmap that we talked about. What do we do to get back on it? To try and redirect them quickly and to know that you're not the adult there to punish them or say, I told you so, that they're sharing their missteps and failures with you. They'll tell you when they've lost their benefits post 18, or they've gotten fired, or they're in danger of losing their apartment. And they communicate those things with you because hopefully you've been able to build that rapport a little bit. It's difficult. But if you can build that rapport just by being the adult who is there, who takes charge throughout their teenage years. And if you see opportunities to do that, like if they need a field trip pass and they're not going to go on the field trip because nobody can find, you know, their pen to write down and get it to the school, you're the adult who comes in and takes care of that. They need the prom dress. You step in and take care of that. If you see opportunities to do those things, that's rapport building for a teenager. That's rapport building. Sitting and talking is one way to build rapport, but showing up and getting things done, getting things accomplished, that builds rapport. And when they fall off the rails, back to your original question, when they slide off the rails, you can be the voice that gets them back on because you've shown a proven track record of knowing what you're doing and caring about them and getting things done for them.
Well, I was going to say the test is not do they succeed, right? The test is do they tell you when they fail? I mean, that's the test of whether or not you're building trust with your client. Not, oh, gee, I failed because they got arrested. No, I'm succeeding because when I went to see them in the detention center, they opened up and they told me exactly what they did. They gave me all the gory details that I didn't want to hear, but they're talking to me. They're admitting it. They're not lying. They're not BSing me. And that's, to me, is when you know you've succeeded in building a relationship with the client.
You're not trying to get these kids to stop falling down. You're trying to teach them to get back up. That's the skill they need for the rest of their lives, because they're always going to be falling down. And so if you've got the skill of getting back up.
Well, we're all, I mean, that's every human on the planet, right? Like, I mean, I think with the older youth in foster care, to your point, the system really just jumps on those weaknesses. And I kind of had to laugh, John, earlier you were saying, you know, we're not this, we're not life coaches, we're not surrogate parents. And we're not. But when you talk about the kind of stuff that we're doing, it's all toward an end, which is permanency, them leaving the system with the skills and a plan for the future. Some of it looks a heck of a lot like life coaching, which is, you know, to really, you know, to what's next. I love that. If every attorney out there representing older youth didn't freak out and get upset and feel let down and take it personally, like, just, it's kind of like, this is the process. Take a deep breath. Okay, what's next? I think that would be tremendously helpful for kids. And we have more we want to talk about with all of you on representing older youth, but I think this is a good place to wrap up here on the strategy, unless John or Jim, you have anything else you want to add?
No, I just, like we've been saying, it's all that teenagers have all this wild energy, right? Especially the clients we serve, and just harness it. Just try to harness it and direct it towards good, and tell them you're doing it. Tell them, you know, you can be a force for good in your life, or you can be a force for destruction. Let's try it my way once in a while, kid, and see how it works for you. See how you feel. That's all you can do. And it's a process.
Yeah. So I think, again, I want to end with the question that I think we should all just keep asking as gems, which is, what's next? So thank you all so much for listening, and we'll be back with more on representing older youth in our next episode. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.